Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of racism, rape, murder, violence, and war.
The people were gathered around the few dignitaries and soldiers present. It was a solemn affair. The Spanish flag was lowered, and in its place, the American stars and stripes were raised over the fort of El Moro Castle in Old San Juan. It was a symbolic passing of the torch. One colonial master was replaced with another. Following the Lares Uprising and the subsequent Glorious Revolution in Spain, Puerto Rico was undergoing a significant transition which affected all aspects of life, including agriculture, politics, and trade partnerships. One thing which remained were the authoritarian governors which Spain had appointed to maintain order and oversee their colony. This was done in order to cow a burgeoning Creole middle class, which identified more with Puerto Rico than with Spain. These same Creoles were experiencing economic growth with new ventures, namely growing coffee. Fernando Pico refers to the 30 years of Puerto Rican history before the United States invaded as the, quote, hour of the mountains, unquote, and with good reason. The population of Puerto Rico was moving inland to the highlands along the Cordillera Central, where humidity, elevation, and soil all combine to create the perfect conditions for growing coffee. Small farmers were growing the cash crop alongside their subsistence crops and livestock. This economic activity turned these small farmers into this new middle class, which was insulated from the authorities on the coast, and as a result, many inland communities flourished. In 1870, as a part of Spain's Glorious Revolution, a new Spanish governor was placed in charge of Puerto Rico, and he immediately abolished the absolute power of the colonial government. At the same time, Spain was attempting to transition into a constitutional monarchy, so they wanted to instill their liberal reforms into Puerto Rican policy as well. The Prince of Savoy, Amadeo I, was in charge of Spain during this period. For a brief moment in time, the Savoy dynasty ruled two of the largest countries in Europe, but it was not to be. Amadeo I would abdicate in 1873 after calling the Spanish people, quote-unquote, ungovernable. Regardless of the short reign of Amadeo I, his administration oversaw what Fernando Pico calls, quote, the greatest political liberalization of the whole of the 19th century, unquote. Political parties were finally allowed to organize themselves on the island. Mayors and town council positions were now elected posts, and over 10,000 individuals who had been trafficked and enslaved were now free of their traffickers. This was incredibly welcome news, as the main focus in Puerto Rico had been placed on abolishing chattel enslavement. Liberals on the island had been petitioning for years for the end of enslavement before Spain finally agreed to make it illegal under Amadeo I. Sugar interests on the island and in Cuba were averse to this and argued bitterly, to no avail. In the last series, we discussed enslavement on Puerto Rico and its impact on people who were enslaved, as well as the effect it had on the Puerto Rican economy. Following several plagues on the island, the population of enslaved peoples was decimated. and many in the new Liberal Reform Party were arguing against chattel enslavement based on humanitarian as well as economic grounds. On the other hand, the Liberal Conservative Party wished to maintain Spanish institutions at large. In time, this group would come to be known as the Incondicionales, or the Unconditionals. Across the island, a high percentage of the people were still unable to vote, but they actively supported emancipation in other ways. Jibaros, or Puerto Rican peasants, and city dwellers alike, were repeatedly punished for harboring quote-unquote fugitive slaves. Besides escaping, people who had been enslaved were murdering or assaulting their overseers, sabotaging work, and destroying haciendas. On March 22, 1873, the Cortes Generales abolished slavery in Puerto Rico. However, the people who had been enslaved were still not granted the same freedom as their neighbors. They were required to work for their traffickers for 3 years and, quote, pay them back, unquote, for the, quote, loss of labor, unquote, in installments over 10 years. In effect, this kept enslavement intact in Puerto Rico for at least 10 more years. Following Amadeo I's abdication, Spain declared itself a republic for the first time in its history. The people of Puerto Rico were granted the rights of free speech, free elections, freedom to worship, and freedom to associate. Unfortunately, the leaders of the first Spanish Republic barely had enough time to get their feet wet before they were usurped by a monarchist's rebellion, which placed the Bourbons back into power with Alfonso XII as their king. Upon his ascent, Alfonso XII decreed that Puerto Rico was now a province of Spain, as Spanish as Sevilla and Toledo. The return to absolutism was swift. The liberal governor of Puerto Rico was replaced with José Laureano Sanz y Pozzi. Prior to his appointment, he had already served as governor in 1870 and was hated for his conservative and authoritarian rule. Olga Jiménez de Wagenheim says as soon as he arrived, he, quote, suspended all constitutional guarantees, banned discussions of reform, and made known his preference for the most conservative social elements, unquote. He mainly sought to disenfranchise the Creole middle class by passing new requirements for voting. By 1879, he had done such a thorough job of purging voters that there were now only 3,000 eligible voters, as opposed to the 20,000 who were eligible in 1871. This greatly enhanced the chances of victory for the Conservative Party come election time. They were helped still further by the liberal reformists, who refused to participate in elections, viewing them as a farce. Within the exiled liberal reformist party, there were two wings of thought. The first group consisted of the assimilationists, who wanted Puerto Rico to be completely assimilated into Spain. Then, there were the autonomists, who wished for the island to be granted a form of autonomy similar to that granted to Canada in 1867. In time, the autonomists would win the battle for control of the Liberal Reform Party and push their agenda in the Spanish Cortes. One of the main voices for this early autonomist movement was Roman Baldoriotti di Castro. He was a schoolteacher who was removed from his post when Sanz y Pozzi took the position of governor. After this, he became a journalist, but he was constantly harassed by authorities. He exiled himself to the Dominican Republic and would only return in 1878. In 1884, the liberals would lose an important election and the party would disband itself, only to reform 3 years later. It was now called the Partito Autonomista Puertorriqueño, or the PAP. After this organization was founded, conservative forces across the island perpetrated a series of kidnappings, beatings, deportations, and murders known to history as the Compontes. The Compontes were initiated under the authoritarian rule of Romualdo Palacio, González in response to the Creole boycott of Spanish businesses. Spanish merchants responded by calling in their debts against all Puerto Ricans, which ratcheted up the tension even further. In time, several mysterious fires destroyed many Spanish businesses. Palacio imprisoned PAP politicians under the assumption that they were the ringleaders who were instigating violence in the countryside. De Castro and many other leading figures in the party were imprisoned under heinous conditions in El Moro Castle. It's impossible to know how many were attacked, kidnapped, tortured, and killed, but the pain and loss the island experienced during the Campantes fueled exiled Puerto Ricans to seek a redress of grievances through American channels, especially in New York City. Beyond this, the ordeal laid bare the government's stance that Creole Puerto Ricans were second class to Spanish-born citizens, and any attempt to address this inequity would be met with harsh reprisals. Madrid saw the fire of rebellion igniting and replaced the authoritarian Palacio with Juan Contreras, who had specific instructions to cease arrests and extrajudicial torture and murders. Olga Jiménez de Wagenheim says, quote, "The problem of the violence continued unabated, in part because Contreras failed to punish the major offenders. All he did in this regard was to fire two of the guards, identified as the torturers." Unquote. De Castro was not the same after his stint in prison. His health was poor, so he decided to resign from his leadership position in the PAP. This created division within the party. The main factions of the party both supported autonomy for Puerto Rico, but they disagreed on how best to achieve it. Some wanted to ally themselves with Republican parties in Spain, seeing them as natural friends. Others wished to ally with monarchist parties, believing they had more of a chance to form a government with Spain's support. However, the Campantes seriously hindered reconciliation between Puerto Rican liberals and Spanish mainland parties for about 4 years. This is when Luis Muñoz Rivera took control of the monarchist wing of the Autonomist Party. He wrote countless essays in his newspaper in support of an alliance between the liberals of Puerto Rico and the Liberal Fusionist Party in Spain. One of the main voices who spoke out against this version of autonomy was José Kelso Barbosa, a doctor who received his degree from Ann Arbor, Michigan. He would come to play a huge role in the Spanish-American War, as well as the initial relationship Puerto Rico created with the United States. It took another 5 years of bitter factional struggle between Republican and monarchist forces before the monarchists finally won out in 1895. They were able to send a delegation to the Liberal Fusionist Party of Spain to propose a political alliance which would grant Puerto Rico its autonomy. 1897 was a landmark year for Puerto Rico and the Spanish state. On August 8th, an anarchist walked up to Prime Minister Antonio Canovas de Castillo while he was sitting on a bench and shot him in the neck 3 times. The assailant said he killed the prime minister as an act of revenge for his arrest and torture of 400 suspected terrorist bombers, of whom 5 had been executed. The head of the Liberal Fusionists was asked to form a government, and he remained true to his political allies in Puerto Rico by asking for the island to be granted autonomy. This was done in the hopes of keeping Puerto Rico as part of the Spanish market and, quote, sphere of influence, unquote, as renewed rebellion in Cuba indicated an intense desire for self-government in both islands. Arturo Moraes Carrion says, quote, "Separatists in exile, led by the venerable Dr. Ramon Amatario Batanzas, joined the Cubans and organized the Puerto Rican section of the Cuban Revolutionary Party," unquote. There were even plans by Cuban rebels to invade Puerto Rico in 1896. The expedition was called off after it was determined Spanish resistance would be too intense. In the first of many instances, war would necessitate a change of relationship between the island and hegemonic Spanish and American states, respectively. In accordance with the autonomic charter, Puerto Rico was now headed by the Governor General. In addition, a bicameral parliament was installed, consisting of the House of Representatives and the Administrative Council. The Governor General appointed the president and his five ministers. Arturo Moraes Carrion says these ministers held the positions of head of, quote, justice and state, of internal affairs, of education, of agriculture, industry and commerce, and of public works and communications, unquote. Beyond this, Puerto Rico now had a provincial assembly, municipal governments, and representation in the Spanish parliament. The Governor General still had immense power and was considered the representative of the crown. He controlled all aspects of military life on the island and could suspend the rights of the press or assembly on a whim. However, he was forced to ban capital punishment across the island, as it would go against the new constitution. Finally, the Governor General was the main representative for the island in all diplomatic affairs, as well as foreign relations. The president, the cabinet, and the parliament were hamstrung with very little real power. They could approve budgets or let the budget lapse into last year's fiscal projections. If councils and legislative bodies failed to uphold the governor's mandates, the governor could simply rule in his, quote, best judgment, unquote, or appeal to the Spanish Audiencia in order to put an end to disputes between the executive and legislative branches. The Administrative Council was made up of positions appointed by the governor, as well as the citizens, but those appointed by the governor held their positions for life, while elections for every other council position were held every 2 years. These councilmen had immunity from most crimes, save for engaging in corruption, while the council was not in session. If charged, they would be tried by the Audiencia instead of their peers. The House of Representatives, meanwhile, consisted of 32 elected members who served 5-year terms and could be re-elected indefinitely. This legislative body was largely in charge of dealing with taxation and public credit on the island. They met once a year for this purpose, while the council met more often, usually to perform judiciary functions. Besides controlling the budget of the island, the legislative branch of autonomous Puerto Rico had the right to determine electoral procedures and establish the voting system. At the local level, the government was controlled by the ayuntamientos. This local council was able to pass legislation related to local health care, education, transportation, and the local budget. These council positions were reserved for those of quote-unquote good standing, or those who were community leaders or highly educated. The first autonomous cabinet was installed on February 9, 1898. On March 27th, elections were held in Puerto Rico, with Luis Muñoz Rivera's liberals winning the majority in parliament. Unfortunately, the Spanish-American War delayed their first meeting until July 13th. On July 25th, American forces under the command of General Nelson A. Miles landed in Juanica, on the island's southwestern tip. Municipal elections were never held, and an autonomous Puerto Rican nation never got to fully come to fruition, for the rights of the people living there were ripped away by American troops. Throughout this period, the rush to lay claim to untouched mountain tracts was intense. Populations in mountain districts were seeing a veritable explosion in population, as well as business activity. Mountain towns like Utuado, Adjuntas, and Ciales were rapidly expanding and becoming centers of business. In spite of this, life was still hostile for many Puerto Ricans. In 1867, the mortality rate was 28.8 deaths per every 1,000 inhabitants, And by 1897, this had ballooned to 35.7 deaths per every 1,000 inhabitants. In some sectors of the island, it was much worse. More people died than were born in San Juan, Quebradillas, Aguadilla, and Fajardo. This dramatic increase in the number of deaths was largely due to new technological breakthroughs in the cultivation of sugarcane and coffee, which required a larger workforce who would work longer hours. Additionally, disease ravaged those who lived on the coasts. This undoubtedly fueled the transfer of the island's population to areas surrounding the Cordillera Central. Tuberculosis and uncanariasis, or hookworm, were prevalent. Meanwhile, the workers' diets worsened. As more and more land in the interior and along the coast was sectioned off in order to grow cash crops. Puerto Ricans began leaving the island as the situation on the haciendas failed to improve. Many moved to Santo Domingo or Cuba, where fledgling communities of Puerto Ricans had been living for centuries. Alongside this external migration, more families began to form loose slum communities in major cities like Ponce, Mayagüez, and Arecibo. This gave these localities the surplus labor required to begin Puerto Rican industrialization. Tobacco factories began to spring up, and the demand for construction workers and longshoremen increased immensely. By the 1880s, all the land on Puerto Rico had been claimed, but the island of Culebra still had so-called common land. Due to this fact, the Spanish government attempted to colonize the island. In 1897, around 750 individuals lived there, attempting to raise cattle. However, the lack of fresh water and adequate transportation made this existence extremely difficult. Following abolition, sugar haciendas fell out of favor as free laborers often refused to work the long hours necessary to harvest the sugar cane. However, several of the larger mills attempted modernization with the money they received from workers whom they had formerly trafficked and enslaved. By the 1890s, many of the remaining sugar mills had refined and updated their processes for sugar crystallization. Fewer people now controlled the majority of farms, a trend which would only accelerate when America annexed the island. The falling price of sugar, alongside the detrimental Spanish tariff, hurt Puerto Rican sugar interests, and this helped push the case for autonomy on the island. Many citizens felt that once they were granted autonomy, the island would be able to trade more freely with the United States. Some Puerto Ricans, like José Kelso Barbosa, began openly collaborating with Uncle Sam. Before this relationship could cement itself and before Puerto Rico was given autonomy, coffee began to outpace sugar as the number one export on the island. Some alarm bells were rung about the dire state of affairs of Puerto Rican agriculture. If blockaded, Puerto Rico would have little food. These warnings were ignored by Creole and Spanish agriculturalists alike in the hopes of gaining profit. A nascent financial sector was closely linked to agriculture in Puerto Rico. But instead of predatory Wall Street tycoons, Spanish and some Creole merchants controlled all the credit on the island. Many smaller producers paid their debts with their crops, creating a semi-feudal existence for small farmers, but leaving the island with little financial debt of which to speak. Merchants with means tightly controlled the access to credit on the island. Ever since Mexico freed itself of Spanish rule, Puerto Rico had no official hard currency. American dollars, Venezuelan pesos, and Spanish reals all passed as acceptable currency in Puerto Rico. And hard money rarely stayed for long before ending up in a merchant's pocket. this convoluted situation in a rapidly changing society was bound to create tension between Spanish overlords and Puerto Ricans who wanted more freedom and financial autonomy. In 1895, the first of many labor strikes began on the island. It was fueled by a harsh trade war between Spain and the United States. This trade war deeply hurt Puerto Rican sugar interests, and many small sugar haciendas went under. This strike revealed a further layer of labor tension, as people who had formerly been enslaved found themselves the target of abuse by their employer, who was also often their former trafficker. Many people who had formerly been enslaved became so-called master boilers, a term used to denote skill in liquefying sugar. Those who had formerly been enslaved were paid less than so-called free laborers and were often forced into an unfair pay scale. In other instances, indebted laborers were forced to work for no money. Fernando Pico says, quote, "As he did not own property, he could offer only his pledge for what he bought on credit in the farmers' stores. Indebtedness was in fact the basic premise of the relationship between employer and worker. As long as he worked, he ensured the prolongation of his credit." Unquote. Debt collectors would exploit this relationship and convince debtors that it was a quote-unquote paternalistic one. This patronizing attitude only served to further inflame workers when the time came for action. There were strikes for higher wages all across the island, but especially in the main sugar-growing areas. The most violent threatened merchants and Spaniards with the destruction of their property. The early beginnings of the Puerto Rican labor movement spread to major cities, where typesetters and artisans were at the forefront of protesting for higher pay. The late 19th century was a period of intense change and growth for Puerto Rico. A massive part of that change was the evolution of the jibaro. These citizens received little formal education and were sometimes quick to violence when an injustice was committed against them. They are a defining piece of Puerto Rican cultural history. Puerto Rican culture was evolving. The Ateneo Puertorriqueño, a cultural institution, was founded in 1876. There was still no college or place of higher learning on the island, but the Ateneo was designed to promote intellectual discussions and cultural advancements. This institution was elitist by design, so many working-class Puerto Ricans never engaged in debate at the center. But for the select few members of the new Creole bourgeois class, the stimulating conversation inspired them. New trends within the Christian world, as well as immigration, led to more Protestants showing up on the island. This culminated in the opening of the first Episcopalian church on the island in Ponce. The danza, a traditional form of Puerto Rican ballroom dancing, was popularized during this period. Additionally, the Afro-Caribbean bomba and plena drums became centerpieces of Puerto Rican music during this time. José Campeche's religious works of art were being replaced by Francisco Oller's secular portraits and depictions of Puerto Rican society. One of his most striking works is El Velorio, or The Wake. It depicts the funeral of a small child. Around the child, various figures mourn, cry, and laugh, but all refuse to look at the dead child who is splayed out on the kitchen table. The only one who dares to look is an older man, who appears to be family. Oller called the painting a, quote, judgmental satire, unquote, saying the painting is, quote, an orgy of brutish appetites under the guise of gross superstition, unquote. It was a scene all too familiar in many Puerto Rican households, which makes its satirical depiction all the more tragic. While Muñoz Rivera was meeting with liberal reformists in Spain, the second and final armed rebellion against Spanish rule broke out in Puerto Rico. The Intentona de Yauco, or the attempted coup of Yauco, was an armed insurrection which was originally devised by the Puerto Rican Revolutionary Committee in New York City. Still attempting to free the island, Emeterio Betances was at the head of planning, alongside Antonio Matai y Uberes. They purchased 30,000 machetes and managed to gather a decent-sized force outside of Yauco. Fidel Velez and José Maldonado Román, known as Aguilla Blanco, the White Eagle, led the men in Puerto Rico. The Puerto Rican flag waved in the breeze at the head of the rebel column. The rebels fell back when met with Spanish entrenched positions on March 24, 1897. 2 days later, another group of rebels was repelled as well. 150 would be arrested, but the White Eagle would escape to Cuba and go on to lead Puerto Rican idealists during the American invasion of Puerto Rico. Following the autonomous charter, those still in jail for the Entontona were granted clemency and released. This was the shape of society when the 1898 war with America began. Fernando Pico asserts Puerto Rico was transitioning into a, quote, agrarian capitalist economy, unquote. Land was not equally distributed, unions were forbidden, employers had total control of their workforce, and most of the population lived as agregados, or service tenants. Most workers lived a meager existence on starvation wages. Employers refused all negotiations with worker representatives, and in one egregious example, José Rodríguez Fuentes closed his factory and fired all 100 workers he had employed. He explained his reasoning, quote, "The industry is going through this temporary crisis because I have lost control of the ship. And when the crew imposes its will upon the captain, the vessel starts to take on water, and it's every man for himself. As for me, I have made it safely through, and my children's daily bread is assured. For if I had sense enough to found this business, and by dint of hard work raise it to its present position, I cannot be blamed if the workers do not measure up to the demands of the job, and poverty rears its ugly head." Unquote. The Central Highway, which connected the north and south of the island, as well as the two most important cities, San Juan and Ponce, was ridden with traffic. The Guardia Civil, or Spanish State Police, patrolled this crucial highway, keeping it clear of quote-unquote banditos. Fernando Pico says they, quote, "routinely intimidated people, provoked conflicts, and on some occasions, there were armed confrontations," unquote. The violence in the countryside had continued without end since the Campantes, and it showed little sign of stopping with the American invasion looming. America had long been interested in the Caribbean. Besides numerous buccaneering expeditions to this area and to Central America, American presidents have shown varying degrees of interest in the annexation of Puerto Rico. They were less interested in the local culture and history than they were with Puerto Rico's strategic position. In fact, most Americans didn't even know about the existence of the island. Thomas Jefferson claimed the Greater Antilles were quote-unquote destined to become a part of America, while James Monroe put forth his famous Monroe Doctrine, which called for the, quote, "end of European colonialism," unquote, in the Western Hemisphere. He failed to mention that American colonialism would go into overdrive. In Piecing Together the Past, Episode 2, we discuss the joint Spanish-American Naval Task Force, which patrolled the Caribbean in search of the infamous pirate Roberto Confresi. In addition to these maritime exploits, Matthew Karp states that the Madison and Monroe administrations, quote, "used overwhelming force to destroy black maroon settlements in Spanish Florida," unquote. Prior to the American Civil War, America was heavily involved in purchasing land from the Dominican Republic, while supporting several clandestine invasions of other Caribbean islands. Henry Adams prophesied, quote, "Whatever the American people might think or say about it, they would sooner or later come to police these islands. Not against Europe, but for Europe and America, too," unquote. Towards the end of the 19th century, European empires were endeavoring to insert themselves economically into Latin America and the Caribbean states once more. America endeavored to reassert itself in the region. Besides strategic interest in controlling Puerto Rico, Cuba, and other Antillean islands, America had vested economic interests at stake. If the peoples living on these islands gained any form of autonomy, it would be bad for Uncle Sam. American imperialists couched their lust for conquest in racial terms. As early as the 1820s, American diplomats showed their disdain for their South American and Caribbean neighbors. John Randolph objected to America's involvement in the 1826 Panama Conference because a, quote, white American, unquote, would be sat, quote, beside the native African, their American descendants, the mixed breeds, the Indians, and the half-breeds, without any offense or scandal at so motley a mix, unquote. While John W. Burgess of Columbia University said, quote, "Teutonic nations are peculiarly endowed with the capacity for establishing nation-states and should be entrusted with the mission of conducting the political civilization of the modern world," unquote. These racist arguments were also designed to appease Southern Democrats. Reconstruction had long ceased, and many attempts were made to reconcile former Confederates. Joe Wheeler, a former Confederate general, was called back into service. In his old age, he forgot he was fighting with the Union and tried to rally his men against the quote-unquote Yankees. American industrialists were incredibly enthused about the war. They wanted to use Puerto Rico as a massive dumping ground for American manufactured goods. Additionally, they wanted to take advantage of Puerto Rican laborers. The invasion would bring with it a wave of speculators and capitalists bent on settler colonialism. This was not the traditional settler colonial project. It did not involve mass deportations nor active genocide. It was based in the insidious exploitation of more than a million people by a few sugar barons for the sake of cheap maple syrup on your morning pancakes. Besides American imperialists, there were also Puerto Rican voices in New York City which were clamoring for assistance against Spain. In 1895, revolutionary leaders from Puerto Rico and Cuba came together in Manhattan and designed the modern Puerto Rican and Cuban flags. Both represent the kinship and bonds of fellowship the islands and their inhabitants share with each other. They sought aid from Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, as well as arch-imperialist Theodore Roosevelt. Emeterio Betances was cautioning his fellow revolutionaries against seeking American help. He wrote, quote, "If the Puerto Ricans don't act fast after the Americans invade, the island will be an American colony forever," unquote. The casus belli for war was given on February 28, 1898, when the USS Maine exploded in Havana Harbor. All hands were lost in the blast, and blame was quickly placed on the Spanish government, although modern evidence points to a mechanical failure on the ship being the reason for the explosion. Regardless, it seems unlikely that the Spanish state would attempt to sabotage an American vessel, since they clearly had their hands full with their colonial dominions. On March 25, 1898, President McKinley demanded that the Spanish government grant autonomy to Cuba and allow American diplomats to mediate the peace. Spanish Prime Minister Práxedes Mateo Sagasta replied that this was fine. He just wished for the Pope to mediate the peace instead. McKinley was not satisfied with the Spanish reply, and on April 11th, he asked permission from Congress for America to enter the Spanish-Cuban War on the side of the Cuban rebels. 8 days later, April 19th, 1898, America was officially at war with Spain. Designated as, quote, number two, unquote, by the U.S. military, the invasion of Puerto Rico was an afterthought for the army. For politicians and expansionists like Theodore Roosevelt, it was one of the most significant islands in the Western Hemisphere. He wrote in May, quote, keep the war going until we get Puerto Rico, unquote. Roosevelt's friend and confidant, Henry Cabot Lodge, replied, quote, Puerto Rico is not forgotten, and we mean to have it, unquote. On May 12th, the American fleet arrived in San Juan Harbor. Prior to this, the American Navy had kept up a deadly blockade of Puerto Rican and Spanish shipping. Fernando Pico says this, quote, exposed the island's incapacity to feed itself, unquote. The repercussions of the blockade were felt everywhere, and desperation was setting in. That's when the American naval shells began falling. The shelling of the city was quote-unquote exploratory, but this did not stop the American Armada from dispensing 30,000 shells on the civilian population of San Juan. This caused a general panic alongside an undetermined amount of civilian casualties. As fast as it had begun, the firing had ceased, and the American fleet departed San Juan Harbor. They would be back with an invading force, consisting of tens of thousands of soldiers. Nelson A. Miles was in charge of the invasion. We have discussed Miles briefly in our episode detailing a second Wounded Knee. Besides ensuring the end of the Great Sioux Rebellion, Miles was a decorated officer during the American Civil War. As war began, Miles was in a perilous political position. His father-in-law was against American involvement in Caribbean affairs, and a new generation of commanders was attempting to usurp his position. Additionally, America's overall military readiness was lacking, to say the least. Troops arrived in their tens of thousands in southern Florida with no training, no provisions, and no equipment. Typhoid fever traveled throughout the ranks, and a general breakdown of discipline began amongst the volunteers. 25,000 men were assigned to the invasion of Number 2. Miles implemented a state-of-the-art health system in order to care for and supply his men. He realized that disease would be their main enemy in the campaign to come, and his preparedness likely saved hundreds of lives. In Puerto Rico, there were around 8,000 Spanish regulars and militia. Following the destruction of the Spanish fleet outside Santiago de Cuba, Spain had no means of reinforcing the island. The initial plan was that American forces would land on the island's eastern tip. But once on the high seas, Miles changed his landing site. American forces would now be landing at Juanica, on the island's southwestern shore. Instead of San Juan being the first objective for the American military, the capital of the island would now be the last. This decision seemed to have been the correct one, as a landing at Fajardo was what Spanish forces expected. As a result, they concentrated the vast majority of their men on the island's eastern half. Additionally, American planners felt that they would receive more support from the population around Juanica, which had been historically antagonistic towards Spanish rule. Fernando Pico speculates other reasons for this change of landing sites in the book 1898, The War After the War. He claims there was incentive for Miles to one-up Navy leadership, as they had brought about most of the victories during the war thus far. It was also felt that if San Juan resisted and was forced under siege, the rest of the island would descend into anarchy and violence. On the morning of July 25th, 1898, American forces disembarked from the Gloucester, and upon meeting no opposition, erected barricades in the center of the town. Figuring it would be faster to travel by sea, American forces solidified their hold on Juanica, raised the Stars and Stripes, and promptly departed for Ponce, the island's largest city. The Spaniards were able to react quickly and redeploy much of their forces along the slopes of the Asomante Mountain. In the time it took American forces to disembark from their boats around Ponce and Guayama, the Spanish had set up a series of defenses. However, the Spanish were in no position to resist a concerted American push, so they abandoned Guayama and left it to the Americans. When a contingent of Americans encroached on Spanish positions from Juana Díaz, they were met with much resistance, but once again the Spanish fell back before a general battle could develop. As Ponce and Guayama fell, a smaller offensive began around San Germán. The city had long been home to violence, as it was the location of the 1511 Taíno Rebellion. Now, it was home to the deadliest fighting during the war between Spanish and American forces. In the interregnum between Spanish and American overlordship, leadership of the city passed through the hands of several armed civilian bands. The pro-American mayor beseeched American forces to liberate his town. They agreed to his request, and after a bitter struggle, Puerto Rico's western half was more or less in American hands. On August 12th, an armistice was declared between Spain and America. Puerto Rico was partly in American hands, but about half the island's municipalities were still nominally controlled by the Spanish. In all, Spanish casualties are estimated at over 400, 17 being killed, the rest being wounded or taken prisoner. 3 Americans were killed, and over 40 were wounded. Across the United States, the campaign was being described as a quote-unquote picnic. For soldiers on the ground, this was the furthest thing from the truth. For them, the most memorable aspects of the Puerto Rico campaign were the, quote, disorganization of the health, food, and transportation services, unquote. General Miles was making clear the intentions of the United States with his landing message to Puerto Rico's inhabitants. It read, quote, the chief object of the American military forces will be to overthrow the armed authority of Spain and to give to the people of your beautiful island the largest measure of liberties consistent with military occupation. We have not come to make war against the people of a country that for centuries has been oppressed, but on the contrary, to bring you protection, not only to yourselves, but to your property, to promote your prosperity, to bestow upon you the immunities and blessings of the liberal institutions of our government, and to give the advantages and blessings of enlightened civilization. Unquote. The campaign's ease was due in part to General Miles and his ability to learn from the mistakes of his counterparts who struggled mightily in Cuba. However, the main reason American forces saw such success against a substantial Spanish garrison was the active participation of the Puerto Rican population on the American side. This participation has been downplayed since by Puerto Rican nationalists and xenophobic American historians alike. The reality was that the Puerto Rican peasants became eager scouts, suppliers, and escorts for American units, and many cheered the American arrival. Others remained supremely indifferent, while a smaller portion preferred life under Spanish hegemony. This last group consisted of the creditors and landowners who had become rich under Spanish rule and enjoyed the protection of the Spanish state police. In time, Puerto Rican peasants, who were instrumental in assisting American advances, would take the initiative still further and begin targeting Spanish businesses and merchant houses. They would arrive in the night in gangs of up to 40 or more people. Their faces were painted with charcoal to hide their identities. They are remembered as the tiznados, or dirty ones, and they would initiate a reign of terror against the landed elites, who for decades had been the ones in charge of the arrest, torture, and surveillance of liberal-minded Puerto Ricans. The Spaniards still in Puerto Rico, who had gained wealth and land through their names alone, were about to be met with hundreds of years of collective anger. The attention of American forces on the island shifted from campaigning to garrisoning. Diplomats from Spain and the United States were in Paris attempting to reach a solution before the war spiraled further. The question of the Philippines and Cuba were already answered, but Spanish diplomats insisted on keeping Puerto Rico, claiming that the island was not a part of the conflict at all, which was accurate in a way. In response, McKinley threatened to continue the war. Having no stomach to fight, the Spanish accepted American demands. Spain agreed to vacate those areas of the island which Spanish forces still controlled within 2 months. At the negotiating table, the fact that Puerto Rico was an autonomous country, similar to Canada, was never brought up. In fact, all efforts were made in the American media to assert Puerto Ricans were quote-unquote not deserving of self-government. A New York Times article titled Americanizing Puerto Rico says Puerto Ricans are, quote, uneducated, simple-minded, and harmless people who are only interested in wine, women, music, and dancing, unquote. As Spanish regular forces pulled out of the barrios they controlled, Spanish irregular auxiliaries moved in an attempt to occupy lost territory. In Ciales, a bloody encounter broke out between two groups of partisans, which resulted in the deaths of 13 people. It was an augur for times to come, and I believe it's fair to call the subsequent period of transition and turmoil Puerto Rico faced a civil war. In Aguada, which was still under Spanish control, a Spanish Guardia unit fired into a crowd, killing 2 people. In the southern half of the island, Puerto Rican citizens refused to pay American taxes, and civil order was largely breaking down. In Ponce, the municipal council believed the American occupation precipitated a new age of political and economic reforms. But they were repeatedly frustrated by the American military government when they attempted to institute new policy, while in Mayagüez, a strange assortment of mercenaries, fame seekers, and venture capitalists had descended on the town like a plague. Amongst the varying groups of people across the island who were looking to settle a score, there were pro-American and pro-Spanish armed bands. But the question remains, were there pro-independence groups as well? There are several opinions on this point. Fernando Pico states, quote, "None of the existing documents consulted bears witness to activities by bands whose avowed purpose was to obtain independence for Puerto Rico or to resist the installation of the American regime on the island," unquote. This does not mean there weren't any armed bands which supported independence. More than likely, those that did kept little documentation of their collective activities. Nelson A. Dennis, meanwhile, asserts that José Maldonado, the White Eagle, fought both Spanish and American forces once he realized American ideals only applied to white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. A main target of the Tiznados were large coffee haciendas in the Central Highlands. Throughout August, September, and October, groups of machete or rifle-armed men arrived in the dead of night. They would bang on objects and shout to wake the people sleeping, and then demand to be let in, or they would set fire to the house with everyone still inside. In most cases, hacienda owners complied. Women were usually left alone, but there is a strong belief that sexual assault and rape occurred, even though there is no concrete evidence for this. After looting the house of any valuables, the hacienda owner and his family were escorted outside and usually forced to watch their buildings burn. In the most extreme cases, the patriarch was humiliated, assaulted, or killed. Many made it clear that their attacks were revenge for the Campantes of the 1880s, or were otherwise directed at Spaniards in order to get Puerto Rican land back. Unsurprisingly, the areas of the island which experienced the most coffee growth also experienced the majority of the violence from the armed bands. Another aspect which made the Tiznados interesting was their composition. Of those accused and found guilty of Tiznado-related violence, a good portion were landless workers, but about as many were small farm owners. Besides the desire to get even on a political level, the Tiznado attacks were aimed at rectifying the economic inequalities between Puerto Rican citizens and the merchant class. In multiple instances, not only were hacienda houses burned, but hacienda stores were also targeted. Inside many of these stores were the ledgers which tallied the debts accrued on the island. The cycle of economic violence continued unabated until American forces began to seriously patrol the interior. With the withdrawal of the Spaniards, this was achieved relatively easily, but this just made it more difficult for the Tiznados to operate. Back in Washington, the euphoria over the conquest of Hawaii, the Philippines, Cuba, and Puerto Rico was turning many fence riders into interventionists and imperialists. Anti-imperialists, meanwhile, were less concerned with America acquiring more territory than they were with who was living in that territory. The Philippines, for example, was inhabited by a variety of Asiatic and Oceanic peoples who practiced an array of religions. Cuba and Puerto Rico, meanwhile, were inhabited by many people who had African and indigenous ancestors. A main goal of the Spanish-American War was to reintegrate the South back into the American fold. And the conquest of quote-unquote lesser peoples had Southern racists and imperialists watering at the mouth. Congress was so enthralled with the cleaving of the nation that they sang Dixie in the halls of the House of Representatives. Back in Puerto Rico, the Tiznados had been growing more and more desperate. They were now shifting their attacks from Spanish hacienda owners to Criollo hacienda owners. Besides this, they began targeting livestock and caravans on the road. Additionally, they demanded payments from many local farmers. It was clear that the Tiznados' time was coming to a close. During this time of desperation, the worst of the attacks would occur a few days before Halloween. 20 or so armed men arrived at Prudencio Mendez's hacienda in Yauco. They demanded 10,000 pesos from the Criollo coffee grower. He said he did not have the amount. At this moment, the assailant who had him at gunpoint shot him in the head, and Mendez fell dead. His body was desecrated with machetes as his sons were tied up. Mendez's wife and daughters were called onto the grisly scene. They demanded the wife shoot her recently deceased husband's body. She refused and she was slapped by the men present. Mendez's daughters were forced to dance and sing around their father's body as the assailants laughed at them. The ringleader was never caught, but five of his accomplices were tried and sentenced to death by garrote, which is strangulation usually completed with an iron collar. But this was commuted to life imprisonment. In another instance, on the first day of December, an overseer at a local hacienda was hanged by a mob of 80 people. None of those responsible were charged. This all led to a reactionary response from growers and landowners alike. They sought protection, petitioning the American military for aid, and Uncle Sam made sure to protect these private interests. Using this powerful tool at their disposal, growers and landowners began a campaign against the meager workers' rights on the island. As a result, strikes took hold across Puerto Rico in 1899, especially in the sugar industry. Attempting to alleviate the situation, the military governor tried to implement an 8-hour working day, but the protests and righteous indignation he received from the grower class was such that he was forced to cancel the initiative. To this day, it is uncertain how much involvement the Liberal Party had with funding or arming the Tiznados. In either case, these groups were likely connected or had overlapped at some level. Toward the end of 1898, the legend of the White Eagle was in all the papers of Puerto Rico. Supposedly, the El Correo de Puerto Rico had received a letter from Maldonado. It's important to stress that this was the era of yellow journalism, and because of that, there's no way we can verify the letter's authenticity. Regardless, Maldonado claimed he had been in conflict with Spanish authorities since the age of 11. He said, quote, "This is the story of my life, and I wish you had printed it in your newspaper, having been the victim of much abuse and many injustices," unquote. He claims the Spaniards attempted to recruit him as a spy and an assassin for the state. He refused, and this landed him on the government's shit list. He claims the authorities cornered him in a sugarcane field near Juana Diaz. He continues, quote, "After 3 days of hunger, I decided to come out. A fight developed between us that ended with their running away after I wounded one of them," unquote. After this fight, he says he left a spare set of clothes with a local who ended up turning them in to the police. The White Eagle found the man and killed him, but now he was on the run again. He went to the Cuban embassy and was sent to Cuba to fight with insurgents against the Spanish. Next, he declared himself a U.S. citizen and spent his days recuperating from an injury in New York City before returning to Puerto Rico to lead the Intentona de Yauco, as well as his own group of armed bands, in the Puerto Rican campaign of the Spanish-American War. He finishes his letter by saying, quote, "A sharp tongue has turned the American leaders against me, and they are pursuing me to kill me. In this view, I've gone to the mountains with a band, and I am ready to punish all Spaniards without harming Americans. But I still restrain myself somewhat to see if I may be pardoned, as I have not committed any crime. But if I am not pardoned, I will not be responsible for the consequences," unquote. Maldonado's pardon was granted, but he got into a violent altercation with police in Ponce while waiting in line for a smallpox vaccination. His band attempted to rescue the White Eagle, and in the shootout with authorities, two of Maldonado's followers were killed while he lost an eye. To Americans, the White Eagle was a bandit and nothing more. American occupation and annexation brought with it many challenges with which the Puerto Rican citizens would have to deal. Enterprising Puerto Ricans colluded with early American military governors. Many became interpreters, and they used their newfound status to demand certain privileges and bribes from their fellow islanders. In one instance, the abuse was so bad that General Miles ordered the arrest of the interpreter in question. The obvious cultural and linguistic divide was detrimental to relations, and many servicemen were angered that they needed an interpreter to, quote, "purchase fresh beef or fuel," unquote. In general, interpreters were preferred to have more English knowledge than Spanish. In many cases, quote-unquote interpreters knew almost no Spanish. Meanwhile, Puerto Rican children took to learning English with enthusiasm. One account says, quote, "Children would walk along the street and hold up an article, saying the word in Spanish until you repeated the name of the article in English. Then they would go on their way, repeating the English word aloud over and over until they claimed it as part of their new vocabulary," unquote. In spite of the jubilant reception Americans received when they first arrived, tensions were starting to brew between Puerto Ricans and American servicemen stationed on the island. The incidents of lewd, aggressive, and violent behavior by American servicemen were innumerable. The most common occurrence were instances of extreme drunkenness. In Mayagüez, it was reported that, quote, "a large number of American soldiers, completely drunk, were all over the street of the town. It was a complete disorder, and it was necessary to ask headquarters for help and requests that they send pairs of soldiers to pick up the drunks, unquote. In other cases, Puerto Rican civilians came to blows with Americans. These scenes were most common in Ponce, while in Cagullas, street battles were waged between townspeople and the local garrison. One brawl in Cagullas, over the, quote, affections of a woman, unquote, ended in the death of an American soldier. Puerto Rican municipal police were also likely to fight with American soldiers. In one encounter, a Puerto Rican police officer struck an American with his billy club, while another American soldier shot and killed one of the police officers. More serious than drunken brawls was the indiscriminate and unprofessional use of firearms in which American soldiers participated. Bored soldiers would prove their marksmanship by shooting empty bottles. In Lares, this nearly killed a sick man, while in Orocoves, a young boy was killed by an American revolver. On the small island of Vieques, an American soldier killed a civilian while out on patrol. Despite the fact that his commanding officer recommended the soldier be court-martialed, no charges were ever put forth. In Arecibo, a member of the cavalry trampled and killed a child who had been playing in the road. In San Sebastian, quote, soldier Charles Anderson, who was in the habit of playing with the school children during recess, somewhat drunk and believing his rifle was unloaded, aimed at the group. The children ran off in all directions, except 7-year-old Juan Evangelista Toledo, who believed this was a joke, as the soldier had often given him candy. All of a sudden, a shot was heard, and Juan Evangelista fell to the ground with his chest shattered. Moments later, he was dead, unquote. These incidents pointed to a stunning lack of military discipline amongst the soldiers on the ground. This was largely the fault of the American military apparatus as well as the American opinions of Puerto Rican citizens. Soldiers who had no respect for the local people rapidly turned to drinking and harassing local women. On October 18, 1898, San Juan was formally handed over to American forces and the Stars and Stripes replaced the Spanish flag. Debates still raged in Congress about what exactly should become of Puerto Rico as well as America's other overseas possessions. As this debate continued, President McKinley ordered the island to be handled by a military government. Eugenio Maria de Hostos was a well-known Puerto Rican separatist, and he created the League of Patriots, which endeavored to petition the United States for Puerto Rican independence. The arguments of the Patriots fell on deaf ears, as the United States was determined to keep the island at all hazard. In response, de Hostos exiled himself to the Dominican Republic, where he died in 1903. Upon hearing of the United States' invasion of Puerto Rico, Emeterio Betances said, quote, I don't want a colony status, neither with Spain nor with the United States, unquote. Becoming incredibly frustrated with the lack of resolve of Puerto Ricans on the island, he asked, quote, and what's wrong with Puerto Ricans that they haven't yet rebelled, unquote. He would die a month before the flag-raising ceremony. It was decided by American politicians that Puerto Rico was unable to govern itself. A period of quote-unquote tutelage began with the official ratification of the Treaty of Paris on December 10, 1898. This whole time, Puerto Rico was technically under the control of two separate governments. General John R. Brooke endeavored to make this transition as easy as possible when he became the first Puerto Rican military governor in American history. He retained many members of the Autonomist Council, including Luis Muñoz Rivera, who was still attempting to secure rights for Puerto Rico. One of the first changes Brooke made was the spelling of the island's name. Puerto Rico was now Puerto Rico. He also set up a military commission, which he believed would more effectively and swiftly punish criminals. Despite being quote-unquote included, Muñoz Rivera detested Brooke and his heavy-handed sense of justice. He wanted to see tangible changes to law and order, not more troop patrols. Brooke was replaced with General Guy V. Henry, who said those who were unhappy with his government should, quote, go to Spain, unquote. He also said he was, quote, giving them, Puerto Ricans, kindergarten instruction in controlling themselves without allowing them too much liberty, unquote. Arturo Moraes Carrion said his main goals were to, quote, improve sanitation, revise election standards, speed Americanization through the teaching of English, establish an efficient policy system, and check freedom of the press, unquote. Henry did away with the last vestiges of the autonomous government when he formally abolished the Insular Council, getting rid of one of his many detractors, Muñoz Rivera. Refusing to be silenced, Muñoz Rivera took his complaints all the way to the White House, where he demanded Henry's removal. Henry's reign of authoritarianism deeply angered many freedom-loving Puerto Ricans. Newspapers which criticized the general's rule were shut down or forced to close. When his abuses and draconian methods were discovered and reported on by the U.S. press, Henry had no choice but to resign from his post. General George W. Davis would take his place on May 9, 1899. He proved much more tactful than either of his predecessors in dealing with Puerto Rican sensibilities. Davis continued the centralization of the island's government, but he did it with the help of Puerto Rican liberals like Muñoz Rivera. This went a long way in mending the wrongs of the past military governors. He claimed his main goal was to prepare the island for a, quote, territorial government, unquote. Besides introducing the right of habeas corpus to the island, he returned criminal cases to the civil courts and streamlined the island's districts. Within months of his arrival, however, Puerto Rico was irrevocably altered by a massive hurricane which swept through the island on August 8th. Remembered as San Ciriaco, the hurricane completely devastated the island. 150-mile-per-hour winds, heavy rains, and storm surges virtually destroyed Puerto Rico's coffee industry. Additionally, the storm killed over 3,000 people while displacing over 250,000, which was a quarter of the island's population. There was no infrastructure in place to respond adequately to this kind of disaster. All Davis could do was set up a quote-unquote charity board while attempting to seek federal aid from McKinley's government, which arrived incredibly slowly. When asked his opinion on what form of government Puerto Rico should take, Davis asserted that the Puerto Rican people needed a period of quote-unquote tutelage in which to develop a, quote, strong middle class, unquote. It was felt that without this factor, Puerto Ricans would be unable to govern themselves. Davis looked toward Great Britain and their example of Trinidad, a crown colony since 1797. Using this as a guideline, Ohio Senator Joseph P. Foraker introduced legislation to Congress which would make Puerto Rico a, quote, unincorporated territory, unquote, of the United States. The greatest hurdle he faced in his attempt to pass the bill was the question of citizenship for Puerto Ricans. Many racist Southern Democrats wished to withhold citizenship. William B. Bate, a Democrat from Tennessee, compared the population of Puerto Rico and the Philippines to a, quote, mass of mongrels, unquote. In this case, Arturo Moraes Carrion asserts, quote, here racism was an ally of anti-colonialism, unquote, as it helped to prevent these territories from becoming incorporated into American states. As a result, the Foraker Act of 1900 refused citizenship to Puerto Ricans but granted them a civil government with an appointed civil governor and an elected House of Delegates. Free trade with the mainland United States would become the economic law of the land after a 2-year-long period of minimal tariffs. The Foraker Act was a solvent to racists in the South and was designed to only be a temporary solution to the complex Puerto Rican quote-unquote problem with which America had burdened itself. Brought before the Supreme Court in the case Downs v. Bidwell, 1901, the Four-Acre Act was upheld. Majority opinion claimed Puerto Rico, quote, belonged to but was not a part of, unquote, the United States. Chief Justice Fuller wrote in his dissent that this decision left Puerto Rico, quote, like a disembodied shade in an intermediate state of ambiguous existence, unquote. This ambiguity was thought to assist Puerto Rico, as the island was not subject to American tax laws. This granted Puerto Ricans some agency in their economic policy, and in most cases, they chose lower taxes in order to stimulate business growth and trade. To prevent monopolization, a 500-acre limit was imposed on businesses. This provision soon proved to be a dead letter, and many massive businesses simply ignored this law, as there was no penalty for breaking it. McKinley named Charles Allen as Puerto Rico's first civilian governor. Many of the old political figures in autonomous Puerto Rico were on the ballot with New Look parties. The Republicans were a mirror of their U.S. counterpart, and they were headed by José Celso Barbosa. He endeavored to turn Puerto Rico into a federal state. The Federals were the Liberal Party rebranded. They were still headed by Luis Muñoz Rivera. After they accused Republicans of gerrymandering the western district of the island, the Federals resigned en masse from their positions in Puerto Rican government. The air was rife with tension when, on September 18, 1900, a mob stormed and destroyed Muñoz Rivera's printing press. This move caused the Federals to detach themselves further from the colonial government. They officially took their names out of the running for the coming elections, leading to the Republicans gaining near total control. The island was now changing rapidly. Coffee haciendas were being replaced by vast tracts of sugarcane fields called latifundia. This process would culminate in Puerto Rico becoming an island of monocultural farming. All this time, Muñoz Rivera was in New York, campaigning for Puerto Rican rights. He wanted to begin a new political movement on the island, which would focus on, quote, government by consent, unquote, as its core value. As long as Puerto Rico had that, he would be content with the island becoming a federal state, an autonomous state, or an independent country under American protection. This new party was called the Unión de Puerto Rico, or the Unionists. Charles Allen set about redirecting the island's entire budget with the assistance of the Republicans. They moved funds earmarked for the building of schools and other public work projects into the hands of large sugar syndicates. Following the San Ciriaco hurricane, Allen brought in his father's lumber company on a no-bid contract and at double the cost to rebuild Puerto Rican roads. The whole time, Nelson A. Dennis claims, quote, Allen had a larger plan, unquote. The governor wrote to McKinley, quote, Puerto Rico is a beautiful island with its natural resources underdeveloped. The soil of the island is remarkably productive, as rich as the delta of the Mississippi or the valley of the Nile. The labor of the natives can be utilized to the lasting benefits of all parties, unquote. Allen finishes the letter writing, quote, Puerto Rico is really the rich gate to future wealth, unquote. On September 15, 1901, Allen resigned as governor. Nelson A. Dennis writes, quote, he then headed straight to Wall Street, where he joined the House of Morgan as vice president of both the Morgan Trust Company and the Guarantee Trust Company of New York. He built the largest sugar syndicate in the world, and his hundreds of political appointees in Puerto Rico provided him with land grants, tax subsidies, water rights, railroad easements, foreclosure sales, and favorable tariffs. By 1907, his syndicate, the American Sugar Refining Company, owned or controlled 98% of the sugar processing capacity in the United States and was known as the Sugar Trust, unquote. This syndicate still exists. Perhaps you've heard of it. Today, the company goes by Domino Sugar Incorporated. Olga Jimenez de Wagenheim sums up the plight of the Puerto Rican island following American annexation well. She says, quote, "By mid-1900, the inhabitants of Puerto Rico had reverted to the colonial past they had fought to overcome for more than a century. Like the Taínos before them, the Puerto Ricans found that conquest was once again justified by the imperialists' desire to spread their own form of civilization. In the 15th century, the Spaniards had invoked religion to justify their expansion, claiming that their mission was to save the savage's soul from eternal damnation. The United States also promised salvation, but of a more mundane nature. No longer able to offer heaven, the new imperialists promised freedom from political bondage and poverty," unquote. In the end, Puerto Ricans were left with more political bondage and more poverty than could have been imagined then. Today, the island owes over $72 billion to Wall Street brokerage firms as a direct result of the unequal, quote-unquote, partnership which exists between America and the island. When America arrived, Puerto Rico had a surplus in their treasury of over 400,000 pesos. Moral and financial bankruptcy always accompany colonization closely. Beyond just dollars and cents, the people of Puerto Rico have suffered at the hands of American policy for over 100 years. In the next episode, I will be covering the chaotic years of tutelage, in which America would attempt to impose reform on Puerto Rico and change the island from the top down, without wondering nor caring how Puerto Rican natives would be affected. American action would lead to the radicalization of hundreds of Puerto Ricans who only wish to have a say in their island's future. They would rally around a man, vilified in his time for his beliefs, but proven right by history. To hear the story of the rise of Pedro Albizu Campos, the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico, and the single deadliest massacre in Puerto Rican history, you'll have to tune in to the next episode of Turning Tides. I'm your host, Joseph Pescone.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, M-O-V-O-P-H-O-T-O. Thank you again.